Hi, I'm Steve Morgan, founder of Cybersecurity Ventures and editor-in-chief at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Frank Fugluzzi, an MSNBC columnist and a national security contributor for NBC News and MSNBC. He was the assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI, where he served 25 years as a special agent and directed all espionage investigations across the government. He's the author of a new book, The FBI Way, Inside the Bureau's Code of Excellence. Frank, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So we've worked with the FBI for years. Most recently, we filmed Ginger, the FBI cyber dog. We've been to the FBI headquarters to film. And I get so many questions from my kids, yet I don't really know that much about the FBI, as you can imagine, you know, being in the media. So you really helped me out because my kids ask a lot of questions. One of them wants to be in the FBI. The FBI Way, your book. A great book. I read it cover to cover twice. So thank you for coming on today and answering some questions for us.
Well, first of all, it's my pleasure. And you've already captured my attention, because whenever you mention a young person who's potentially thinking about a career in public service or even in the Bureau, I get really excited about that. Because as I talk about in my book, my interest started at about age 11. So I love the idea that actually a young person might pick up the book and become further inspired.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give a copy of the book to my son. He's a junior in college and he's studying criminal justice and he's serious and he does ask about the FBI.
Awesome. I would tell your junior in college about the FBI Honors Internship. And maybe he or she gets to apply for that. It's a great summer program for college students.
So, Frank, I want to ask you. You retired from the FBI, I believe, was in 2012. Is that right?
Yes, the end of August, 2012.
So, right. You waited 8 years to write the book. Why?
So, Steve, I've done something that I swore I would never do, which is write that book about, you know, your FBI career and give some inside skinny on things. I didn't want to be that person, but here's what happened. We've spent the last 4 years hearing about one person's opinion about the FBI, largely coming right out of the Oval Office. And because of circumstances and scenarios, some of which, by the way, are on the FBI, some of which are not, I got deeply concerned about the FBI's credibility and the perception of the public of the FBI. Because here's the bottom line. When you flash those FBI credentials at the front door of somebody and ask for their cooperation on a case, if they pause for a minute because of some misperception about the trust they can have in the FBI, the success of the FBI can fail. And I decided it was time to write a retort to the misperceptions of the Bureau. And that's really what this book is about. In fact, my retort is that not only is what you're hearing about the Bureau incorrect, but the Bureau should be held up as a model of leadership and values preservation, something that leadership students call values-based leadership. It's really a model. I've distilled that down into what I call the seven C's. And it's a way for you to learn not only about some great inside stories about the FBI and how it handles internal compliance and preserves its core values, but also how you as a citizen, someone who's maybe involved in a club, a community, a company, a country, can actually determine what matters most and protect and preserve it the FBI way.
Well, society needs this, because I think that most people, no matter who you are, can name one, two, three, maybe a half dozen people who are in the FBI. You see their names in the media, or they have a leadership position, but they're not familiar with who the FBI really is. It's comprised of so many people who valiantly serve, and you know they don't get public recognition, of course.
Yeah, I dedicated the book to the rank and file men and women of the FBI, who, in my opinion, are what I call imperfect heroes. They're human beings, but they do heroic things every single day, much of which the public never even hears about. And yes, there have been a small handful of senior executives that have contributed to the public perception of the Bureau in the last few years and have literally handed President Trump an excuse to bash the Bureau, rightly, wrongly. And again, that's part of what I address in the book.
So you've been described as the FBI's, quote, keeper of the code. I believe this stems from your appointment as chief inspector by then-director Robert Mueller. Who is keeper of the code? What does that mean?
Well, first, it's a figurative term for the purposes of the book, but it literally means this, that there were times in my career where my specific assignments were related to preserving the code of the FBI, the code of conduct, the core values. So as part of my leadership advancement, I had roles in what many people would call the internal affairs sections of the FBI. I was a chief in a unit responsible for the Office of Professional Responsibility. I had to make very tough calls on disciplinary decisions in internal misconduct allegations against FBI employees, very good people who, because of stress, because of judgment, because of errors, screwed up. And I had to make those calls in an attempt to balance compassion and fairness with preserving the core values and code of the FBI. Much later in my career as a senior executive, I became the chief inspector of the FBI, responsible for the most sensitive inquiries, reviews, audits of programs and personnel in the FBI around the world. But here's the point of the book, and it goes to my second chapter. We talk about the seven C's in the book. The first C is code. You've got to have a code. Your company, organization, your country better have a code that flows from its core values. But the second C, Steve, is what I call conservancy, which is this concept that preserving values and leadership is a team sport. So when I say, hey, for a period of time in my career, I was a keeper of the code, what I'm really saying is the FBI way is to treat every single employee as a steward of the core values. Everyone is a keeper of the code. And I suggest to the reader that you should be as well.
So, Frank, we don't want to steal your thunder. It's a great book, and people have to read the book. I insist they read the book. So we're not going to give away too much. But you gave us the first two C's. Can you give us the other five so that people know what those seven C's are?
Yeah, look, I've kept it simple. It's an easy read, and it's the takeaways of 25 years of life inside the FBI that can apply to you and what you do and your family, business, et cetera. And yeah, we start with code, which is based on your core values. That's the concept that here's what we believe in. Here's what matters most to our organization. We move on to conservancy, which is that we're all a part of keeping this code because we're part of something greater than ourselves. And I think we've learned that in this nation during the last 4 years. We then move to what I call clarity, which is everybody's got to be on board. And this can't be a surprise. What we stand for, what matters most to our organization, our business, our company, our nation, better be crystal clear. And the FBI has bright, what they call bright lines in its internal disciplinary process. If you do this, this will happen. This is what matters most to us. In the FBI, it happens to be lying under oath. From there, we move on to consequences, which I think people, even in corporate life, Steve, people are very remiss to get involved in consequences, right? They want to soft pedal it. It's unpleasant to think about, hey, what do we do with this person who's undermined our company, our code? And they wrestle with that, but I say you've got to have clear consequences as well. But I balance it with the next C, which is compassion, right? There shouldn't be an algorithm where a computer can figure out what to do with misconduct. It should be run by humans. Your compliance program, your security program, your integrity program has got to be balanced by compassion. And I tell some really human stories in there that have been cleared by the FBI for the first time. After compassion, we move on to credibility. You've got to have credibility as someone who is a keeper of the code. If you're going to be looked at as someone who's preserving the sanctity of an organization, a family, a business. And here's the thing, credibility doesn't mean being perfect, right? This is not a book that says the FBI is perfect, nor that you should be perfect in your life. Rather, credibility is about transparency and coming forward and getting it right, even when you get it wrong. And the FBI screws up plenty of times. It's really high profile and on the front page when that happens. But I give examples of how major errors in the FBI have caused improvements through transparency. And then lastly, I end with consistency. that if you stick to a rhythm in your life, your business, your leadership, where you're passionate about getting it right, and even under the most severe stress, you stick to your strategy and your formula, not with rigidity, but with the ability to say, this is what matters most to me. I'm not compromising it, even when it's painful to stick with it, then you'll come through it. And I believe the country will come through the period we've just been in.
So, Frank, did you take that code with you, even though you hadn't yet written the book? In 2012, when you retired from the FBI, you went to work for GE. You were the assistant chief security officer there. Clearly, you had the credentials for the position, but was that code important to you?
So first, I'm glad you asked that, because I think a lot of the viewers and listeners today are coming out of the corporate world, where I spent 5 years as an executive, in this case with General Electric. I sought out a company that stood for integrity, that I knew had strong reputation for internal compliance, for getting it right, had won awards for ethics and integrity. I wanted to be a part of that organization, and I saw that reflected in my 5 years at GE. So that code matched pretty darn well. I went from protecting the nation's secrets and preserving the FBI's core values to protecting a company's core values. But I will say this, the transition for those, and people who are listening who've made the transition from government service to corporate life will know that those early years, those months and first year can be very difficult in learning the culture. But if you find that there's a strength of code and core values and people believe in it, you'll be okay. But I found another thing in corporate security, Steve, about these seven C's, which is they apply to securing your company. So here's the deal. Let's take it beyond ethics and integrity, and let's talk about the seven C's as they pertain to security. If you know, let's start with that code, those core values, and let's translate it to security professionals understanding what matters most to the company. I can't tell you how many times, Steve, I've run into very professional security careerists who still can't tell me with clarity what it is they're protecting in their company. What matters most? What cannot walk out the door? What cannot be extracted or exfiltrated in a cyber hack, because that would pose an existential threat to the company? When I do consulting, when I was in my corporate life traveling the globe for a global Fortune 10 company, I would ask security professionals in every region, what are you protecting? And right down to the guy or gal watching the monitors in the control room on CCTV. What are you watching? What are you looking for? What are you protecting? What goes on in that building? What would you be concerned about happening? And very often the answer is, I'm not sure. I don't know. And so let's get the core values of security right. Let's understand what we're protecting. Let's be clear about it. Let's understand the consequences of it. And you'll go a long way towards a successful security program.
You know, in some ways, your book is a tough read, and it's a compliment. And what I mean by that is, when I read the book, I was hoping to learn a lot about the FBI. And I did. But the book challenged me. You know, the book also spoke to me. And I suppose that's the case with chief security officers. If they read the book, you know, it challenges you to adhere to a code. It asks you if you have a code. On a personal level, I have 6 kids, so we have a big family. But even if you have, you know, a small kid, or if you're on your own, you know, do you have a code? What is that code? Or does this code, you know, make sense to you? And I think about our audience, a lot of chief security officers at Fortune 500, Global 2000 companies. And at some level, I think the book can make them uncomfortable, because it's going to challenge them. It's already an uncomfortable position. You know, they're dealing with hacks and breaches. You know, you understand that. But it asks some really good questions. Do you think that the code can enhance a security team?
I think not only can it enhance your team, but I think it's actually necessary. If you're out there functioning without core values and a code that's clearly communicated to your team, you're likely to be spinning your wheels. You really are. And you're likely not to have meaningful metrics to gauge your performance either. And what concerns me the most is, under time of stress and crisis, and boy, security executives around the globe have to deal with crises on a daily basis. When that happens, we often jettison our principles and our values and our strategies and our protocols because we think, well, this is a crisis. I've never seen this before. And therefore, the solution must be something different than what got me here. And I found in the FBI, I give the example, Steve, of the first anthrax murder in U.S. history. I became the on-scene commander of that site in Boca Raton, Florida at AMI headquarters, where a man had died from anthrax poisoning in an office setting. And the FBI had never dealt with a hazmat environment in a deadly anthrax-filled building, three stories, 60,000 square feet. And it would be easy for us to say, my God, this is unprecedented. We're not sure how to approach this. And we're going to jettison our protocols for search scenes, crime scenes, and hazmat. We did exactly the opposite. We said, this is a crime scene. This is a hazmat scene. We've done this before. This is different. It's more deadly. But we're going to stick to what got us here as an organization. The same thing can be learned for security directors. The time to get your protocols and your understanding of what matters most right is now, not during a crisis.
I guess it's challenging on another level too. So on the one hand, you have a chief security officer, you have their team, but then there's the question of the company's morals, ethics, and code. And perhaps CISOs don't think about that as much as they should. You went into a situation, as you said, where you singled out a company, you gave that a lot of thought. But of course, you know, in our career movement, that's not always the case. People move from position to position. There's finances to consider. And you can, you know, find yourself becoming very introspective, asking yourself about this code or your own personal code, and then looking at the company, and there could be a disconnect.
Yeah, and I get it. I've lived the reality of corporate life and the different equities and stakeholders that are involved there. And there's a reality that you have to deal with. You're going to, for example, it would be very easy for security professionals to say, we prefer not to operate in high-risk environments, right? But the reality is that's where clients are, that's where manufacturing is, that's where the customers are, and it's got to happen. And so you've got to figure out how to do that, but still preserve what matters most to the company and to you as an individual. I give an example in the book of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the day I'll never forget where I was a second-ranked official in FBI Miami. At the time, FBI Miami was responsible for the FBI's deployment to Guantanamo Bay, where the detainees, the Al-Qaeda detainees, were being held. And my agents came back to from Cuba one day, came into my office in Miami, closed the door and said, boss, we're walking out of interviews at Guantanamo. The interrogations are things that we can't witness, and they certainly will not produce evidence that we can use in criminal court. That started a very long, unpopular process of investigating what was happening at Gitmo and whether or not the crisis of 9/11 and the detention of hostile combatants at Gitmo meant that we would throw out our values as an organization and as a nation that would ultimately undermine our core values because we might be participating in what's called enhanced interrogation techniques that were not working and were actually undermining any criminal use of the material. So we did something very unpopular in the intelligence and military community. We raised our hand and said, this isn't right. This ain't working. It undermines all of us. And it went to the White House, where ultimately George W. Bush decided to give the FBI responsibility for high-value interrogations. It's just one example of where you've got to stand up and do the right thing, even when it's unpopular, even when it's painful.
Right. So, Frank, nowadays you're a security contributor, national security contributor, so you're helping the nation in another way. How concerned are you with the recent activity, cyber warfare activity, attacks on companies, including SolarWinds and FireEye? Does that give you a lot of concern?
Look, it should concern every single citizen. I wrote a column recently on this for MSNBC Daily on why we should care about the SolarWinds hack and what Russia and others are doing. This should be a massive wake-up call, and I'm not hesitant to call this a failure. We've failed as a national defense community, in not detecting what the Russians have been doing. We've been so singly focused on election security, understandably, that we missed. By the way, those threats primarily coming from the Russian GRU, military intelligence. We missed the SVR approaches, or we looked the other way or ignored the signals. I don't really care how much or how it happened, but it's happened. When the top 10 telecommunications companies have been impacted, when SolarWinds has become a single point of failure, exploited by the Russian intelligence service, impacting 300,000 clients around the world, we should all be deeply concerned. And it seems like every day we're learning of another agency, from DHS to NSA to DOJ, Commerce and Treasury, that have been impacted by these hacks over the past few months. And, you know, we've got to take this threat seriously. And another reason I'm concerned about it, and I address this near the end of my book, Steve, is that the bad guys don't care very much about how stovepipe the U.S. government might be, or who's in charge, or what the battle plans are. They don't really care. While we're wrestling over, hey, what part of the FBI handles this? Is it the cyber division, or the counterintelligence division, or the counterterrorism division? The bad guys are having a field day with us. We got to get our act together. And President-elect Biden is going to have to deal with this on day one. And it's potentially possible that Putin has thrown down a cyber gauntlet, saying, look, not only am I doing what I can in the last days of the Trump administration, but you're going to have to deal with me on day one.
Frank, should we have a chief security officer for our nation that transcends all agencies and is elevated? A chief security officer that has more authority than anything we've had before?
So this is a great question. If, you know, the business model seems to work, and why we're not copying that on a federal government level, I think is a very valid question. There's too many stovepipes in how we address security. The DNI was supposed to be that coordinator of our nation's security. I actually am of a mind that we need to beef up. And I know I'm going to have some former colleagues there saying, oh, no, please don't do that. But I think the DNI position needs to be beefed up. And needs to have even more power and authority than they do. And maybe that evolves into kind of the chief security officer. And I'm going to say this, and it's controversial, but it's in the book, which is we need to have some kind of, you know, you talk about threats to the country. We need to have some kind of enhanced vetting process for the most senior positions in our government, whether it's cabinet, Senate, Congress, Supreme Court, and even a presidential candidate. Now, I've been misinterpreted on this concept, Steve, by those who say, wait a minute, are you talking about some bureaucracy or some panel that needs to actually select a candidate or a president? No, I'm not. But what I'm saying is the vetting process publicly, where the media watches a candidate or digs deeply into a nominee for a few months or a year, has not worked well for us. And there's stories in the book about my own career confronting elected and appointed officials who I knew were working with a foreign service. Our system does not work. So things like mandating tax returns, mandating disclosure of foreign financial entanglements, publicly doing that, I think would go a long way, and kind of feeds into your concept of, hey, you know, there's a chief security officer who's looking at this somewhere or saying, yes, this candidate has submitted a fulsome disclosure of his or her background.
Wow. Maybe you're a candidate to be our chief security officer.
Well, I often wonder whether I can do more good outside the government, educating and thinking about these topics than inside the government. But I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about this because I think it has to be a national discussion.
Right. Well, I think you'd be pleasantly surprised, you know, how unpolitical a lot of your commentary is in the cyber community. I think that, you know, there's a lot of bipartisanship and there's a lot of pragmatism and, you know, it just makes sense. And, you know, we're all about securing the nation, securing businesses. You know, politics is second.
Yeah, I have to tell you, Steve, personally, it has pained me to be perceived as political, not only because of the particular network on television I'm associated with, but because so much of my commentary has sadly had to been focused on a political party and a polarized nation. But what I really see as my mission is educating the public as to threat, getting better at security. And boy, if somebody had told me 20 years ago, you'll be on TV someday regularly talking about counterintelligence, I would have asked two questions. Number one, are you crazy? And number two, what in heaven's name has happened that requires me to educate the public about the foreign threat?
So, Frank, we have a lot of chief security officers, chief information security officers who tune into our media. They will be watching this video. Do you have a message for them that you'd like to share? You know, we're in such a strange time right now. There's a changing of the guard. We'll have a new president soon. We're coming out of a pandemic, I hope, I pray. We're still in it right now. And these chief security officers are charged with a very difficult job. Any advice, any insight for them going into 2021?
First, here's some good news. I think that if you've been able to survive and thrive in this period of time and show your value to the C-suite and the board of directors, you're going to make it. This has been an opportunity for all of us to show the value of security in what could have been an existential threat to our businesses and perhaps even our nation. Secondly, I can't emphasize enough that it has got to be a complete partnership. You know, I talked about stovepiping. I talked about the FBI having separate divisions. I cannot emphasize enough the need to marry up physical security with information security. The behavior of people and the behavior of data are inextricably linked. And the companies that think they've got everything handled because they have a great information security director, or conversely feel like, hey, we've got a really strong physical security program, we're great, they're missing the mark. The year coming up should be a time to marry those two disciplines together and understand that securing your entity is about getting it right on the physical and cyber side like never before, because the threats we're facing and are about to face are going to come at us fast and furious.
Right. Well, that's great advice. You know, we recently interviewed the chief security officer at HCA Healthcare, a Fortune 100 company, and he was very unusual in his bio. We talked about it in that he does exactly what you recommend. So he is responsible for physical and information security. I think that's the case for perhaps 10%, if that many, CISOs at large enterprises.
Yeah, I learned my lesson well, not only in the Bureau, but particularly in a major global corporation, that the insider threat, detecting and resolving insider threat, understanding what's being targeted in your company is truly a marriage of physical or what I call human security and data security. And you will not come close to defeating that threat if you don't understand what that marriage needs to look like. And increasingly, I think insider threat is something that's going to be with us for as long as we have employees and data that other people want.
So before we let you go, Frank, circling back here to the book, you're going to have a virtual launch for the book on January 15th. It's at 7 p.m. East Coast time. And that's with Natasha Bertrand, national security correspondent at Politico. Where should people tune in for that?
Yeah, thanks for that. There's the shameless book plug that I'll throw in. Natasha Bertrand, many people are familiar with her from her incredible reporting in the national security community for Politico and her appearances on television. She's young, she's smart, and she was my first choice to moderate the virtual launch Friday night, January 15th. To reserve your spot, just go to the largest independent book company in New York City is doing the launch. It's called The Strand. So if you go to strandbooks.com/events, strandbooks.com/events, or simply go to eventbrite.com, you can reserve your spot and you can help us kick off the launch of the FBI way.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yep, stay safe and stay well, Steve.
I'm Steve Morgan, founder of Cybersecurity Ventures and editor-in-chief at Cybercrime Magazine. Visit us on the web at cybercrimemagazine.com. Joining us today was Frank Fugazi, an MSNBC columnist and a national security contributor for NBC News and MSNBC. He was the assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI, where he served 25 years as a special agent and directed all espionage investigations across the government. He's the author of The FBI Way, Inside the Bureau's Code of Excellence.